call to order. There he is. I'd like to call to order this November 21st, 2017 work session of the Springfield Planning Commission. This evening, we have one item. We have 90 minutes set aside, and this is for us to, it's a review of the Transportation System Plan Implementation Project. Emma Newman, Senior Planner, is going to kind of talk us through it. It looks like there's a lot of support staff here and folks available and some committee members. I see familiar faces who have been part of the planning process. So I'll turn it over to Emma.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
I'd like to start off by introducing the project core team. Although I'm presenting tonight, there's been a great core team working on this project, and I owe a lot of gratitude to them and their contributions. So we have Mark Russ in the audience here, who's also working on the core team. Michael Labler, right next to him, and Christina Krebs has also provided legal support for the project. So just to recap briefly, since it's been a little while since we've been here, January 20th, 2016, you met as the Committee for Citizen Involvement and looked at the scope of work for the project and endorsed the stakeholder engagement plan for the project itself. On June 20th, 2017, you received a communication memo updating you about the drafts of the Springfield Development Code, proposed changes going for review for some public input, going for review through the stakeholder group and technical review team, which I'll touch on more. And then I want to highlight that Commissioners Bowes and Dunn have both served on the Stakeholder Sounding Board throughout the process, so they've been a little bit more intimately involved as we've developed content for this project. A brief overview of the components that we'll be talking about this evening. There are three chunks. There's the Springfield Development Code amendments, the conceptual street map, which we have a visual on the wall, and then the TSP project lists and figure updates, which we also have visuals that I'll speak about a little bit later. So following the House Bill 3337 passage, it first established the requirement for Springfield to have our own comprehensive plan and transportation system plan. The TSP was adopted by City Council in July 2014, and it established the high-level goals and policy that's already been established for our transportation system, and directed this project to launch and then implement the policies at that kind of where the rubber hits the road level, where the Springfield Development Code comes into play. State rules require that the TSP not only be adopted, but that there also be these implementing regulations. So that's what we're focused on here. The project's task is to take the higher level policies, which you'll find in attachment 2 from the transportation system plan. Chapter 2 goes through all the different policies. We looked through those and then looked at, okay, how is this applicable to our development code? How can we take these policies and implement them with the development code? Here's a little review of the process. So we had a few different groups, as I said, engaging. We had staff developing the draft content, and then at each review, there's an iterative review process. We go to the stakeholder sounding board, as well as the technical review team. And the stakeholder sounding board had a lot of continuing members from the TSP project, the transportation system plan process itself, so there's good continuity. It was an iterative process that had the stakeholders weigh in, the technical review team weigh in, and then we also had quite a bit of involvement from a management staff team that was called the oversight team, and they have provided feedback. Once we captured feedback, we take it to them and say, here's our proposals, what should we adjust? So it's gone through a few different review processes, and now we're bringing it to you to start the process and get your insight a little bit more, instead of just the commissioners who were involved in the stakeholder group, to develop and refine the code amendments, the conceptual street map, and then make correlating adjustments to the TSP project list and figures. The bulk of the work was performed by city staff, as I was saying, and then incorporating feedback as we went. Are there any questions so far with this portion?
Questions.
You have one? No. Okay. And then going forward, this is where we're at tonight. Going forward, it will be a co-adoption process for each of these three elements with the city and the county. So the County Planning Commission and then the County Board of County Commissioners with the City Council co-adopting. Here is a list of the stakeholder sounding board members. As I said, a lot of these members had been involved in the stakeholder advisory committee that served in the development of Springfield's first, Springfield-only TSP, the 2030 Transportation System Plan. The Stakeholder Sounding Board aimed to represent a variety of different interests and also had the commissioner liaison positions and Councillor Wiley serving on the stakeholder group as well. I'd like to also highlight that the Stakeholder Sounding Board really provided a lot of great discussion on certain elements that staff wanted input on, and then those requests and feedback were incorporated into the revised drafts as we went. And the stakeholders were unable to attend meetings. We did additional follow-up with those members to make sure that they haven't had an opportunity to really weigh in on the content. So chapter 7 of the TSP is where these goals for TSP implementation come from. That was also provided in your packet as part of attachment 2. And these are the goals set out to guide the process. The whole chapter 7 is one page. It says, here's how to take the next steps to implement the transportation system plan by updating the Springfield Development Code and by adopting the conceptual street map with these goals in mind. So the needs of the transportation dependent and disadvantaged, focusing on system connectivity, supporting and promoting walking, biking, and transit, transportation facilities and land use planning and permitting process, and updating and adopting the conceptual street map. So this really was the guiding document and showing us here's where to launch off for this project and what still remains to be done now that the policies have already been adopted. So the three components that I'll walk through briefly, and then I have further examples to provide once you jump into each discussion item, but I figure do the relevant content a little bit more detail when you're ready to discuss. So the first item is the Springfield Development Code Amendment. Second is the draft conceptual street map. And thirdly, the TSP project list and figure updates. And all three of these components will need to be adopted through a land use process. So for the development code, there are a few different types of changes. We had substantive amendments that were implementing the policies. We had some changes for to the engineering design specifications and procedures manual. So as we were doing this project, we realized that there were some elements that historically had been moved out of the development code into the EDSPM that really should reside in the code since they are land use regulations. So a couple of items were pulling things back from the EDSPM instead of just saying reference this section, we're pulling it back into the development code, as well as some engineering design specification and procedure manual updates that are really of a technical nature that should reside there, but that need to be updated to correlate with the changes we're seeing here. And then there's also housekeeping amendments such as typo changes, updating to the current plans, some slight adjustments to definitions to meet the current situation. And some of the EDSPM language items that are being pulled back out of the EDSPM into the code, such as illumination standards and medians, those will be coming to you at your next work session. We don't have those quite ready. So they're just highlighted in green throughout your packet saying, here's a placeholder coming soon. And that's an attachment 5 is the bulk document for the development code changes. Any questions at this point? Here are the overarching kind of headers, if you will, of the sections that had substantive changes within the development code. You also have your table of contents at the beginning of attachment 5 that can help orient if you're trying to find a specific section. That moves us on to section 2. So the second item is the Springfield draft conceptual street map. This was updated by staff and then a subgroup of the technical review team, and then reviewed by the project oversight team and went through several iterations. It needs to be officially adopted through the proper land use approval process, which will be, you know, another component of this project. It's staff's suggestion on how to implement the policies that have been already adopted and have been provided the direction for this project. It's helping achieve the system connectivity goals that I highlighted as one of the guiding goals for the project. It helps serve all modes of transportation as stated in the TSP implementation goals. The update and adoption of the map is specifically stated as a charge for the project in Chapter 7, as I just read earlier. And then the draft's intent is to implement the policy direction and ensure that we have a high-quality community that has good system connectivity and has a transportation system that's really fulfilling the community's needs. Another item that we were trying to address with this is secondary emergency access. So if there's a road where you can only access it from one route and that route gets blocked, then that's a concern for being able to respond. The map shows arterial, collector, and off-street path projects that are adopted as official TSP projects. And then it shows conceptual local streets that are subject to the Development Code street connectivity standards that are in section 4.2105-105 in your packet, attachment 5. So I'll show some examples once we're going to walk through this section and discuss the item later on. But this is the kind of high level what this is. The third section of this evening is the TSP project list and figure updates. So there's a variety of different changes within here too. With the development of the conceptual street map and adjustments to that, there are items that need to be adjusted in the TSP project list to be consistent. For instance, we wanted to make sure that the collector network connected to one another so you didn't have one type of facility that had a gap in the system. So we have some projects that we adjusted in the conceptual street map, and then they needed to be adjusted in the TSP. There's also projects that have been shifted to be consistent with the regional transportation plan, and that's a regional plan that's adopted through the Regional Metropolitan Policy Committee, which our mayor and city council, we have representation on that committee that's for the Eugene-Springfield metro area. And then additional needs and our opportunities were identified, so some adjustments for those. And then some housekeeping updates, such as like typos, clarifications. And I'll show examples later about that as well. Just stop for a second. Any questions on the three sections that we have?
I don't think so.
Okay.
High level.
Next
specific questions.
Yeah. So we're here this evening, and then we're planning to go to the City Council for a work session on December 4th, and that's to give them another overview saying, okay, here's the different components, this is where the project's at. Then we have a joint county and county planning work session, so for this body to meet with the County Planning Commission on January 23rd for a joint work session. That same evening, we tentatively have a public hearing and you could start deliberating, you could recommend if you wanted to that evening on January 23rd as well. And that would require public notice in mid-December. There's a requirement to provide public notice 20 to 40 days ahead of time to all of the real property owners within the Springfield city limits and the Springfield UGB. So we can talk about that a bit more later as well. And then there's an optional joint hearing and recommendation on February 6th that's scheduled, but all of these are subject to change. So it's really a matter of how much do we get through this evening and then how much time do you want as an individual planning commission? And then how many meetings do you want with the joint planning commission with the county? And then after that, it starts processing through the city council and the county board of commissioners for their co-adoption process. They'll have their own work sessions and regular sessions with public hearings. So that's generally where we're headed. And we'll loop back around to this slide at the end to discuss where we've gotten to by the end of the evening and what we want to do moving forward. So this is my general proposal for time allocation. It gives you a sense of how big the different portions are and where you might want to spend your time. For each section, I do have examples to kind of walk through a little bit more detail of here's some of the changes that are being proposed. So you can look at those as well as bring up items that are of interest to you from your own review. And then lastly, I like to highlight that there's the project website. So especially anyone in the audience, if you want to access any materials, all of the materials are on the website. The TSP in its entirety with its executive summary, all the appendices, links to the development code and the DSPM. There's the FAQ sheet. All the public meetings have been posted there and will be posted there as you continue to meet. And then there's all of the proposed changes and draft content available as well. So any questions? Are we oriented?
Good.
with that, I will start going through some of the development code examples, highlight some specific sections. So this first section is addressing public streets, and one of the policies in the TSP was looking at how can we provide good connectivity in our system, but also allocate more space toward economic development. So finding that balance between how much space is going to the public infrastructure to serve development sites, and then how much is actually allocated to sites to develop. This table 4.2-1 addresses minimum right-of-way and curb-to-curb widths. And initially, this table looks like this in the current code in this form. And then this is also on pages 10 and 11 of attachment 5 if you want to follow along with the full document.
I think it's on page 15, attachment 5, page 15.
Oh, sorry, 15 of the Planning Commission packet, yeah. 10 through...
I think it's 12 on the...
12, yeah, 12, sorry, 12, 12 on the... Yeah. If you're looking at the bottom right, it's 12, it's 15 if it's on the bottom of your page. Two different numbering systems.
So we missed chapter 3. Yes?
Yes, we are going to skip around and kind of highlight some bigger items, and okay. Then it's up to you to lead the discussion once I've presented a couple of things.
Okay.
If you'd like to do it that way.
That's fine.
So as you can see, the original table is up top, and there's strike-through highlighting for all of the things that are being proposed to be removed, and then underlined highlight for any additions. We have gone through several versions of this table with feedback from the Stakeholder Sounding Board and the Oversight Team, striving to provide more clarity and yet also provide more flexibility to developers. Recognizing that some of the larger streets on here are going to be city projects and are going to have a more involved planning process for such as like a major arterial street, Main Street, and I heard Commissioner James talking about that earlier, about city talking about that. But so that's a more involved process, but it also just says, okay, here's all the different classification streets. We wanted to specify if there is parking required or not within the width, because the current table, it just has one width, and it's kind of up to the developer to assume how the space may be used, but our revised version actually shows here's how the space is intended to be used. If you would like to have parking on two sides of the street, this width is required, which is the furthest left width. If you want to have parking on one side, that's the middle number. If you want no parking, that's the furthest right number, and those three numbers shown. We've also added the columns to include bicycle lane width and the planting strips, and this is also in accordance with the sidewalk standards that I'll be sharing in a moment as well. I think it's also important to highlight the section leading up to this provides more information about site-specific engineering design standards, including but not limited to requirements for multi-way boulevard or more modern roundabout designs. So it's kind of incorporating what we're already doing on the new Franklin Boulevard project and future projects where we might want to deviate for safety and engineering considerations, but are not specific to what's shown as the minimum requirements in the table. And these are just establishing minimum, so we can do more than this, but it's just what could be expected. We received feedback when we took this to the stakeholder group that they really liked these visuals that we provided as a tool for a better understanding, and have since added them into the actual development code so that they are illustrative, and they're only one example of how a street could be configured. This is one that would be a major arterial with parking on both sides. I'll show a major collector with parking on one side, and then a local street that would be pretty flat, less than a 15% slope with no parking on the street. And then those finger numbers correlate on the left-hand column of the table there. So that was responding to the stakeholder group saying, really helpful to have visual representation of one way to do this, but elements could be swapped.
Commissioner Cuevelo is pointing out, we love some of the cars that you dropped into some of these illustrations. If you look at some of these, there's a Ferrari, and there's a you know.
A couple of
old...
Citroën Duchevaux.
I don't know who did that, but you were very creative.
I tried to have enough variety so it didn't look the same on each one, but... So if there are no questions on that one, I was just kind of, or we will move on to the next one, which is block length and perimeter. And this is pulling from the policy direction in the TSP, which is attachment to your TSP chapter 2. It's talking about the continuous transportation network that is reasonably direct travel routes to destination points for all travel modes. We looked at that policy in the action, as well as policy 3.5, which is addressing the mobility and safety needs of motorists, transit users, bicyclists, pedestrians, freight, and the needs of emergency vehicles when planning and constructing roadway system improvements. We also need to ensure that the current design standards address mobility needs and meet ADA standards. So with that direction, we looked at the block perimeter and block length section of the code, which you'll find on page 25, and I'm going off of the lower right corner numbers, if you're following along. And the goal of this section was to set standards so that it really does serve all the different transportation needs with the network, that you don't have to go super far out of direction to walk to a destination that might be very close as the crow flies, but if you were to walk, if you have to walk a really circuitous route, and it can take a lot longer and deter people from walking, biking, taking transit. And as well as making sure that there's enough connectivity throughout the system so that there is secondary access. If something happens on one street, people have another way to navigate home, or that fire and EMS could respond. So with this, we researched some other communities, but would also really like your input on the block perimeter, which is the total block lengths from all sides of the block added up. We're looking at 1,400 feet in mixed-use districts consistent with the standards in section 3.2-625E. Looking at 2,600 feet in the industrial zoning districts, and then 1,600 feet in the other zoning districts. And I'd like to call out further down on the page, if you're looking at the code document itself, we have exception language that provides that the director may authorize a block length or block perimeter that exceeds the applicable maximum specified in this section. But in order to do so, in authorizing a block length and block perimeter that exceeds the above maximum length, the director may establish requirements for interim street connectivity and or pedestrian access ways with consistent standards consistent with section 4.2-160. And then further down, specifically item 3 within the exception, industrial development areas greater than 25 acres are pursuant to an adopted master plan. So for very large industrial sites, we're saying there's an exception so that that can be developed, and there's going to be a lot of planning involved with that large of a site anyway. So they would have an exception to work through a master plan process instead. I also have, along with this visual, these are on each side. Some handouts with specific locations that are in Springfield that provide an example of block lengths so you can help visualize what this might look like. For instance, this one shown on the screen is right across the street, Kitty Corner to City Hall. And the Washburn Historic District is looking at about 1,400 feet for a typical block perimeter. Examples have little descriptions of what it's showing, as well as some examples of some longer blocks that longer and like larger blocks that wouldn't fulfill this that provide connectivity challenges in our transportation network. Any questions on this? I have a couple more development code examples, and then open it up for discussion.
Examples.
The next one that I'd like to highlight is motor vehicle parking. So this is pages 31 to 38, you wind up in the lower right-hand corner. So starting at the section, we pulled out some of the TSP policies that we're guiding for these changes. Policy 2.7 says to manage the off-street parking system to assure major activity centers meet their parking demand through a combination of shared, leased, and new off-street parking facilities and TDM programs. TDM is Transportation Demand Management, so that can be promotion of walking, biking, transit, could be telecommuting, all sorts of ways to reduce vehicle trips on the system. And then action one, modify parking requirements to assure that they are appropriate for land uses. The purpose of this action is to reduce parking requirements to utilize land for economic development. So we're thinking, how can we provide more flexibility within our parking requirements so that if parking spaces, surface parking spaces are not required and wouldn't actually be utilized, can we provide the developers an opportunity to use more of that space for economic purposes on their site and provide a little bit more flexibility? So one way that we look to implement this is table 4.6-2, which is the requirements for number of parking spaces based on the use, pages 36 and 37. We have proposed in this section to add a parking maximum, which a lot of communities have, and Springfield hasn't had a parking maximum throughout the city until this proposed change. It would be 125% of the minimum space required, and then it could be exceeded by the exception potentially, where the director could approve additional parking spaces if there was a parking generation study that made the case for the need of the additional parking. And then this other TSP policy, 3.8, says to coordinate the design of Springfield's transportation system with relevant local, regional, and state agencies. And action three within that says partner with LTD to provide frequent transit network connections along major corridors. The frequent transit network should connect local neighborhood bus service and major activity centers to provide viable alternatives to vehicle trips. So the frequent transit network is established just like these other figures and maps that show the corridors within Springfield that have frequent service. So it's about, you know, 15-minute bus service, the MX corridor fulfills that, those types of routes. So we're looking at like Main Street, Pioneer Parkway, and we were thinking about this policy in conjunction with the previous policy that I shared. And we wanted to provide some flexible options for parking reduction. So keeping that in mind, if you want to flip back to page 33, sections G through the end there, M, provide a variety of different options for reducing the number of parking spaces below the minimum shown in the table that we're just looking at. So there would be an opportunity to reduce vehicle parking based on additional bicycle parking being provided, and that would be up to 15% reduction for that item, and that was already in the bike parking area. We already had a provision in the code that said if you provide additional bike parking, you can reduce the number of parking spaces necessary. Then we were thinking about this frequent transit corridor, and if there's a site that's directly on or very close to frequent transit service, it's more likely that those sites might have people traveling to and from them with using the bus and not driving quite as much. So we thought that a provision for that might be appropriate. So there's a motor vehicle parking space reduction credit for frequent transit corridors for abutting sites, and for that it's up to a 15% reduction from the minimum. For sites that are nearby, which is defined as within a quarter mile of an existing frequent transit corridor, they may request a reduction of up to 10%. And then because there's a large need to fulfill the ADA requirements across the city with installing ADA compliant curb ramps, we are looking at a reduction credit for ADA improvements for frequent transit corridors. So this one is saying a developer could pay into a fund and help fund ADA ramps so that people can access the transit more easily. And one curb ramp fee would appropriately match 1 to 4 parking spaces reduced. They could pay into this fund and then be able to reduce the number of parking spaces required by increasing the access to transit.
Quick question. Could these be cumulative so that if you get 10% here and 15% here and another 15% here, you can end up with a 50% reduction?
Well, that's the answer to your question. Yes, section L right here addresses just that, because we were looking at, okay, here's a lot of different options, but then if people take advantage of all of them, that could be a pretty drastic reduction. So it says that outside the downtown exception area in Glenwood Riverfront mixed-use plan district, which have different parking requirements, a cumulative maximum reduction of 25% of the minimum off-street parking would be required. So he said you could provide as low as 75% of the total minimum required if you employ these different strategies. That being said, there's also an exception language, section M, that says that the director may authorize directions or reductions to parking beyond what's shown as those options if there's substantial evidence. So people can go the extra mile and say, we have a site that's going to have very few vehicle trips and here's why. And if they make a compelling case by providing substantial evidence, either through a parking generation study, providing something like, we're really close to a multi-use path and a lot of our users are using that. If they're providing, say, work incentives for paying employees to get to work that way, to reduce the amount of parking spaces that they'll actually be using, this provides some flexibility for them to reduce beyond or reduce in different ways. Great question.
Does this address parking for ADUs?
That is a separate section, and I could defer to Christina if you want to comment on the ADU section.
Well, I know we've had conversations around.
Yeah, and I've been speaking with Sandy as well, answering some of her transportation-specific questions in relation to the ADA work that you're doing.
Good.
Yeah. The next section that I'd like to highlight is bicycle parking. We use the regional bike parking study as the foundation text for this section. It was a study that was done, completed in 2013 with agency partners, Point to Point at LTD, LTD staff, Eugene, City of Eugene. There was a regional effort to assess current bicycle parking facilities and then what the community would like to see in the future going forward. So with the changes, they mostly update the rack type, requiring to have a high quality rack, and a staple or inverted U rack fulfills that. It's a rack that has 2 points of contact and it's less likely to have a bike slip over and damage the bicycle while being parked at the facility. Clarified short-term and long-term parking and what that requires. Added oversized bicycle parking space requirements, which is an item that we heard from our stakeholder sounding board and we love your input on. Defined what a convenient distance from the primary point of entry was, and then condensed the use table as well to try to fulfill the same goals of specifying what's required for different uses, but not have, you know, a 3 or 4 page table instead of have a
was this
page
was this table. Also reviewed by the BPAC? I know you had member representation mm-hmm. from the BPAC on the advisory
group. Yes, we had
group.
Two members serving on the stakeholder sounding board from the BPAC, but we also took the development code to a BPAC meeting and
good.
Said we would like your input.
Excellent.
And they provided some good feedback on that. So I just wanted to highlight, if you're less familiar with kind of where things are going with a lot of bicycle transportation, we're seeing more and more different types of bicycles being used, which we're calling oversized bicycle parking needs. It could be an adaptive bicycle that's providing more bicycle opportunities to people who may don't have the typical, or not typical, but maybe don't have the mobility in their arms or hands. They could use a different type of bicycle. Could be families transporting kids around, general cargo bike use to carry more stuff. So we're looking at adding a section into the code that says we need to provide a certain number of larger bicycle spaces so that that can be accommodated. And this was brought up by the stakeholder, and we'd love to hear what all of you think about it. A couple last things. I hand out for this as well. So this is one example, just briefly covering how we're bringing some of the language from the engineering design specifications and procedures manual back into development code and implementing the policies from the CSP. So as you'll see, section C here has a bit more technical standard language that was being referenced, but now we're bringing it back into the code, such as making sure that sidewalks do not have obstructions, such as mailboxes, water meters, valves, junction boxes, manholes, utility poles, etc. That's just an example for you to be familiar with those types of changes that we're bringing into this project as well. And then lastly, some of the housekeeping amendments, examples of those. There's a whole housekeeping section at the end of attachment 5, the development code proposed changes. We're replacing TransPlan, the previous transportation plan for the region, with our own Springfield Transportation System plan. So that's the current adopted document. We've changed, replaced the public works director with the director, and then changed the definition to make sure that the director is referencing the development and public works director. Those sorts of housekeeping and Scrivener error changes. With that, I think that's the end of that section. So if you'd like to discuss attachment 5.
Absolutely.
Love to hear feedback.
Well, I have, I'm sure the other members do as well. I have several items just to bring attention to. Section 3.2, page 2, you have that section, you've included linear parks throughout those land use designations. And I applaud that. I think that's timely. It's a good thing to do. And so I appreciated that being brought into the code. So that was one thing I wanted to point out. I also had, you have a lot of this is just housekeeping work. You've done things instead of calling it the TransPlan. You've taken all of that out, and because this is Springfield's transportation plan now, and so you've changed that terminology. I noticed one of the things that I really noticed going back to your chapter 2 goals. There's much greater implementation, or much more directed, much more directed look at bike traffic and passive and mobility and some of those types of issues. And you've incorporated many of those concepts into this document, I think, in a way that are timely. I think your BPAC has been very active now for, is this the third or fourth year? It's been a while.
Third year, that's been quite active.
Third year. And I see some goals in goal one, goal two, all of them really that really point to not only the street transportation and car transportation and traffic, but also supporting bicycle and pedestrian systems, multimodal type transportation, and I think that's incredibly timely, and it's well reflected in some of the things you pointed out here in these sections. Back to the bicycles, in the section, in the bicycle parking section, one of the things that you pointed to some larger parking spaces for different types of bicycles and things of that nature, and I appreciated that. And I don't know how the city is dealing with the issue of electric bicycles and those types of things. And it probably would not be enumerated here, but I know Willamette Lane, with all of the paths and things that they have to deal with, there's much more popularity now with different types of transit that folks can commute, not necessarily on a standard pedaling bicycle, but it may be some sort of a electric mode of transportation that might coexist on some of those pathways and those types of things. So where might you deal with that in municipal code, I guess?
Yeah, so I think when it comes to electric bicycles and those sorts of devices that deviate from a standard pedal bicycle,
yes,
there's some state regulation as far as speeds that are set, so that we defer to in Springfield. It's set statewide. If you wanted to look more specifically at development of specific sites, if you wanted to consider charging stations for electric bicycles, that's something that could be added in that we haven't proposed, but could.
Well, I think, you know, this is really a 20-year look, and I mean, I go out and I see the different modes of transportation now, and there are a plethora of different things out there now that will go 20 kilometers plus, and if you're a commuter and you don't necessarily want to ride a bicycle, there are lots of other things that are out there. Not that we're going to incorporate all of that into a solution here, but I think to neglect that, you know, even if you put some language in there that says, that addresses other future modes of transportation or something that may, you know, and I'm thinking specifically charge stations, things of that nature, because I think those things are reality, and in an urban environment, I think we're going to probably very potentially see more and more of that. So, other comments?
I like some of the flexibility with development in terms of the credits towards the parking, because I was just in the Whitaker last weekend with my friends, and the parking was awful. And I'm hoping that ride sharing gets pushed through, because I think services like that, there's going to be, you know, like all of our friends, we would have just ride shared to the location, not had to worry about parking. And so having developers having that flexibility, I think will be a good thing.
Other questions or issues?
I emailed you a rather large list of things, and I'd like to point out one thing on the document you just brought in on sidewalks, particularly C5, the obstruction reduction. My feeling is that the items that are really could be flush with the surface of the sidewalk, it would be not economically feasible to ask for some of the surface items like junction boxes, water meters, water valve tiles, and manholes to be moved, because they're flush with the sidewalk. They can be made textured, so they're non-slip surfaces, etc. And the cost of moving something like a water valve means that you have to go all the way down to the water line, close off that water valve, dig up another big hole someplace else, and then install it in another location. A sewer manhole or a storm drain manhole, the cost to install one of those could be $11,000, $20,000 to move one of those. For the purposes of a sidewalk, I think that the relocation of flush items is really economically a bad, would be really difficult to comply with for a lot of developers.
Commissioner Quavila, I think that if something is flush with the sidewalk, then it's not, wouldn't be classified as an obstruction.
But
this is really intended to, it would be to the extent that a manhole acts as an obstruction, it would not be able to be in the right of way. And this is really to implement ADA clear width requirements, so we're obligated under federal law to do this anyway, to the extent that they block the clear travel path.
However, the wording does not specify that.
Says in
so we can update the way that it's worded to make it clear that.
Yeah, it'd be huge cost to do something like that.
There is also, you'll note in there, the ability for the city engineer to allow anything that would otherwise be an obstruction to remain if there's otherwise ADA compliance in the sidewalk. Like if you have a 10-foot sidewalk and there's something that obstructs 2 feet into that, that could be allowed to remain because you've got your more than that, your ADA requirement.
I understand that.
So
but I also think that if you need to involve the city engineer in really minor decisions like flush mounted items, it's, and again, not a wise use of economics.
Okay. Other questions or issues?
Well, my last one, as long as you don't make me read this again, would be something not related to transportation at all, but just terminology. My family runs a statewide nonprofit for people who experience disabilities and for them to advocate upon them for themselves. And if it would be at all possible to reference, instead of disabled persons, persons who experience disabilities, I think that would be more in line with the future terminology that class hopes to be displayed as: people first, who experience disability second. It's just a few times in there. Again, nothing to do with transportation, but much like the Americans Who Experience Disabilities Act, people who experience disabilities is more in line with the terminology that we would hope to use than disabled persons.
Thank you.
Excellent.
How I missed that the first three times, I don't know.
I just have a semantics question. You know, I mean, I'm a contract guy, and I, you know, my career and that type of thing. I see a lot of shells being stricken, and maize being included, and shells be stricken and musts inserted, and you know, I think an overriding what that says to me is you're a lot, and you addressed this early on, it allows more, a little more flexibility, a little more give in this, in those situations where maybe a different approach might be better. And you've done a good job calling out alternate ways to address when you may be in a situation where, you know, we might have used to said it shall be this way, and you've at least given some reasonable paths around that. Maybe you can talk about your thinking around those types of that type of language usage.
Definitely. So there are sometimes changes that we're proposing from a required language to a may, which is flexible,
right,
given the conditions. That being said, I'd like to defer to Christina with regards to the legal implications. We were mostly changing shall to must if we were already editing that section of the code, but not seeking out opportunities to just change that one item, recognizing that there's a broader code rewrite project that's being talked about, and the code itself has a lot of different iterations being changed over time. So it will take an overhaul to get everything consistent when it comes to that. But Christina, do you want to speak to shall and must?
Yeah, I think as you identified, Commissioner James, shall can be legally problematic in some uses, because there can be a differing interpretation of does shall mean an affirmative duty, must, or does shall mean something that more along the lines of should. And so where we are, the city's general position has been that shall is a mandatory term, that shall means must. So where possible and where we've identified, as I explained, we're already making changes, just to be clearer and less legalistic in our language, we're using must in place of shall where it is necessary, and then only using may where we really truly mean that to be a permissive clause.
Right.
There have been a few instances of the use of the word may under some of these older standards where it really wasn't permissive. It was an obligation. It was a standard that had to be met, but the wording was potentially confusing. So trying to be consistent in that. So if you identify any places where that's still inconsistent or it's confusing, that would be helpful to have those slides. Or any instances, any uses of the word shall that look problematic where they are that we should address, or we've not otherwise flagged them.
Excellent. Thank you.
I had another couple of questions that also relate to semantics. One was, I'm not certain, I'm sure probably everyone else knows what a linear park is, but I myself don't know what it means. And then there was another term used, a proportional exactment, that I wasn't sure what the definition of that was.
So page 60, the final page of attachment 5, has the definition for linear park.
Thank you.
Which is a public or private park that provides public access to trail-oriented activities, which may include walking, running, biking, or skating, and preserves open space. A linear park consists of a multi-use path, pedestrian trail, or bikeway, and related facilities. I think you asked in your initial comments that you sent earlier today also what's an example of that. So the Middle Fork Path is a type of linear park. So it's a park facility that has a multi-use path that also has the trailhead amenities that provide access to a facility. And then the second part of your question.
It was proportional exactment. No, location of it was on, I believe, page 25.
That's in the TSG itself.
Okay.
Is that?
On page 25. Talking about. That's
what I'm talking about. Of the attachment to the TSB or of the core language?
Probably the attachment to the TSB. Attachment 2, I believe. Yeah. TSB review, attachment 2, page 25. Proportional exactions.
Is it within? What is the page number on the TSB itself? Sorry.
25. Attachment 2.
24, 25.
Action 5
under policy 4.1. It says require that new development pay for its proportional.
So that's a TSP. So backing up to give the overview real quick. That is a TSP policy that we're not implementing through code language. That has to do with how our system development charges are structured, which is not part of the current project, but a proportional exaction in that sense is a constitutional legal term that relates to the city is not allowed to exact money from a developer for an improvement that is discretionary unless it is proportionally related to the impacts of that development.
Great.
And so that's what that means.
Thank you.
But it's really to do with how we set up our SECs and not our code language.
Thank you.
Perfect. Okay. Other questions? Now there are, yes.
I had a question about that 125% maximum parking rule you were talking about. Reading here on page 37 of the TSP itself, page 40 of our packet, it says that it's the maximum will be 125% of the minimum, and I understand that might make sense for large parking lot with a lot of cars, but then if you take the dwelling single family duplexes or manufactured homes, it changes the minimum from 2 to 1 or 2 depending on on-street parking. So I guess my question is, if it's a single family dwelling on a street that has on-street parking, what is 125% of 1.25 parking spaces? Is that rounded up?
Thank you for clarifying that. So the table has been changed to split out residential at the top here, and there's no maximum applying to the residential section.
Oh, okay.
And then the maximum is being added right here, and then for everything following, it says footnote 2 applies.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So when might we see section C And the items marked out in green, when might those additional, you know, bike lanes?
Yeah, the EDS CAM sections for the next work session. All the green highlights.
So the, as I indicated, the parking issue for ADUs is scheduled to go to the city council, and that language would be or has been incorporated into this, or will be, or what?
Yes. Christina, do you want to speak to where that
the
is located?
ADU parking standards are in a different section of their, that language appears only under the ADU standards themselves.
Okay.
And isn't in the table 4.6-2, what is referenced in the ADU code are the standards for the primary dwelling unit. So if the primary dwelling unit with an ADU meets the or exceeds the parking required under this table, either as before it's amended or as after, then additional parking spaces under the version that you recommended to council, additional spaces that single family dwelling, the primary unit has, would count, could be used for the ADU. So that's the only way that these proposed changes might impact the ADU parking standards. Otherwise, the ADU parking standards are more complex. They require consideration of different factors, the way that you've recommended to city council, a discretionary path or a requirement that could be negated by the presence of on-street parking. So those standards will still remain in the ADU section only and will not be referenced in this table. It's really only the primary dwelling. And the justification for that is that ADUs are an accessory use that get reviewed only as a standalone application.
Kind of like an AIA document with standard conditions and then supplemental conditions. You have to go 10 different places to find it. What I heard you say was you pulled some of that information that made sense into this document for other places that it resided so that you could go one place and get to the long and short of what the requirements were.
So what I was trying to articulate was pulling the engineering design specifications and procedures manual content that is actually a land use approval piece of content back into the code. This project did a little bit of cleanup within the work that we were already doing where it was made sense, but we have not done a larger scale code cleanup.
But that is
trying to stay within the
that
scope
is
of this
in
project.
Process. That is in process.
Yes,
now,
that's a
right?
separate. I mean, that's a separate
whole
project.
Separate
that we're trying
process.
To wrap up sooner with
yeah,
this to get
yeah,
this
I totally
implemented.
Understand. Totally understand. Okay. Any other questions? Well, you know, I just applaud the work that's been done on this code refinement. It's tough work. I mean, it really is. I mean, I've been through these processes before, so I think it's. I think it looks generally, it looks very good at this stage. I think you've had good answers to our questions. We'll look forward to seeing the other components of this at a subsequent work session. Maybe we should go ahead and move on to your second piece.
Thank you. Okay, section 2. This is the draft conceptual tree map, and we have the draft on the wall over there as well. So I just wanted to orient one more time to what this map consists of. The arterials, collectors, and off-street paths that are shown on the draft conceptual street map are adopted into the transportation system plan itself. The local streets, which are shown as black lines on the map, are conceptual. And then the street connectivity standards from the code document that we're just looking at, section 4.2-105A1 and then section A through C, which are on pages 10 and 11, if you're looking at the small numbers on the right-hand side.
Yeah.
Those are the code language that kind of work in tandem with the conceptual street map. And then just a reminder, the conceptual street map will need to be adopted as well. As we've gone along with these various maps and we've been working through a lot of great content, there have been a couple of minor edits that we missed that were just errors between not showing a project on one map and showing it in another location. So we're making that consistent, doing some polishing and cross-checking with that going forward. I just wanted to walk through some examples of these locations. We can look at a map like that, and then it's hard to see, okay, what does this actually mean on the ground? There's a variety of different types of streets to achieve the street connectivity goals that we have and provide that secondary emergency access, as I was saying, as well as access for, you know, someone who's just trying to access their home. Maybe there's something going on one street. It's nice to have options on how to get to and from your place of employment, your home, your destinations you're trying to get to. So one example is the 10th Street location. We're showing a little black line on 10th Street, and there are plenty of locations that are shown on the map that have existing right-of-way. You can see the street, 10th is gravel, kind of fairly well used to the alley on the south side there. All the right-of-way exists. It wouldn't take much to connect the street through, and we're showing those sorts of connections. Just nearby, 8th Street, just north of Springfield High School, south of Centennial. There's most of the right-of-way available. The house on Centennial burned down, and the city purchased that house to provide street through there. It was in conjunction with some of the stormwater work with being done as well. Another example, so up in the Gateway area, this is Harlow Road, Gateway, Oakdale, and Pheasant, make the outside of this super block, if you will. All of the, where it says private and then that other street network right next to it, those are all private circulating streets within the apartment complexes there. And there's no street connecting Oakdale to Harlow anywhere between Gateway and Pheasant Boulevard. So we're looking to provide a connection through there. It's showing the local conceptual street. And in order to have this actually built, either one or both of the larger sites there would have to come in to redevelop and go through the whole development process, and then we could provide connectivity to the stubbed out cloverleaf loop, which you can see the street's there, it almost goes through, but it doesn't yet. Another example where some of the right-of-way exists but a lot of it doesn't yet is out in the Thurston area, just south of Main Street. We're looking to provide more street connectivity that parallels Main Street so that Main Street doesn't have to have the burden of quite as much traffic and serve all the purposes for our community. So Astor Street from 59th to 63rd, you can see that one little segment's been vacated and Astor exists, and then there's another segment that's not vacated, there's a little portion that is. All of these sites, as they go to redevelop, would vacate, and then eventually you get the street built through there to provide the connection. Another example is off of Mohawk. There's 16th and 17th Streets. We are showing a connection. There's a church that owns multiple different parking lots and they're building over on the other side. And we're looking at both of these streets and they don't have any connection. So if something happened down here on 16th and there wasn't any access, emergency vehicles couldn't go in and actually service any of those homes. So trying to connect those types of situations as well. Another example here is kind of in a mixed county and city area where some properties have been annexing, but there's been county development standards over by Centennial Elementary School. There's Rainbow Drive that stubs out to the south, West Olympic comes in and almost connects to Nighthawk, and then West End Street provides a good backbone for the neighborhood, but doesn't have that connectivity yet. So in order for this to actually be connected, it would probably require the city purchasing the sites that are preventing that connection from happening. There's kind of a range of different types of street connections that we're showing, but the intent is to provide that system connectivity as the guiding goals for the project stated.
Does this include east-west connection? I know you've worked on that a lot along the on the east side of, I mean, on the south side of Main Street from 32nd Street out to the Thurston area?
Yeah. There's some TSP projects. I'm going to pull up the map itself so I can zoom into locations that you might be asking about.
And also leveraging the Hall Road. Mm-hmm. I see you have the Hall Road is a nice black line, and I know that's an access, a future emergency access road for future development out in the Jasper Natron area.
All right, a large file. Getting over there. So, dash purple is signifying a multi-use path, which could also provide access for emergency situations. There's some additional connections to kind of the newer development areas on the fringe with local streets. There's not a like any connection through the Willam Lane area itself, but there is the TSP project that would provide another connection here, so there weren't, you know, there's a little bit more east-west connectivity in the middle of our system. That's what's shown there. And then also for the TSP project that increases some connectivity
along
in that
the,
area.
Yeah, along the river there.
I guess, do you have questions? Do you feel as if our overall approach is the right one to take to be able to implement the policy and adopt the conceptual street map in accordance with the TSP direction?
Well, I think it's going to take me a little while to study this, and I'm sure I will have some questions. I really appreciate the inclusion of, for instance, I know that you had business and transit and all, a bunch of folks. How involved were they in development of this specific piece?
They were involved in the development of the code changes a lot. The Springfield draft conceptual street map was developed. It's been in use in a draft form to some extent, and then staff did a more thorough review and provided more revisions because we knew that it would be coming through this process. A subgroup of the technical review team, which involved the school district and Willam Lane, weighed in as well. And then it was shared with the stakeholder sounding board in their second round of review. And we received some comments that we responded to from stakeholders, but there wasn't, you know, time at a meeting dedicated to diving into the details of it with the stakeholder sounding board.
I noticed that, you know, you've included the home to school concepts in your goals, and you know, some of those types of things. So, you know, I think it's been a good process. I think, you know, when we're talking about adopting this conceptual street map, I mean, I want to make absolutely sure that the right eyes have seen it and it's been vetted really well, because this is going to, you know, set a plan in place well into the future. Code amendments can occur periodically, and you know, we'll live with these until something else comes in and we have to deal with them, and we need to amend them and move forward. This, how frequently do we update this?
I'll let Christina speak, and I think our other core team members might want to chime in.
So I think it would be helpful to give the sort of the background of how this document will be used, because I think that will answer part of your question. The TSP itself requires us to, and the transportation planning rule that's a state regulation, requires us to have an adopted system for collectors and arterials. So we are required by state law and our own TSP to have the part of the map that are the collectors and arterials put down on paper as the plan for the future of how the system's going to function. With regard to local streets, we have some flexibility in how we establish our connectivity for local streets. We can have a map that we require everything to be built per that map, and some jurisdictions exclusively do that. We can also have connectivity standards that govern where streets will be planned in the future. We've taken a hybrid approach, so you'll also see in your code language in 4.2.150, or, sorry, 105.
Page 11.
page 10 and 11 on the lower right. We've had existing connectivity standards for local streets, and then we've used sort of a draft form of this map to help inform developers of how those might look on paper. Mm-hmm. So the local streets that are shown on here will not be adopted into the TSP itself, but they will be approved by a land use planning process. And the point of that is to basically give a developer sort of a form of choice. Build what is shown on the map that the city has in advance said this meets our system connectivity for this particular where there's a street shown, or if that street needs to be moved or altered or does not work with a developer's specific need, or there's a site constraint, then the connectivity standards that are written in the code would apply to where that road should go. So it's the local streets will be adopted on this map, but there is a mechanism via the code to change a segment if it's not going to work for one reason or another, but that has its foundation in the code language.
And also thinking about some of the more minor connections, like for instance those ones up on Rainbow Drive, there will be lots of opportunity for the property owners in the area to be provided the connectivity plan and to provide input before any of the projects go on to the CIP. Would that not be correct?
Correct. So all of the real property owners in the city will be notified of this project. That being said, it's just the adoption, as Christina just explained, of local conceptual streets. In order mm-hmm. for that street to be built, we need to acquire the property. And we can't go in and just say, okay, we're going to take the sure. houses and plow mm-hmm. through the streets. That's not the intent. It's to say, here's the connectivity goals of the city. Here's the big plan so that 50 years from now, if things are changing, we can start to accomplish some of our transportation system connectivity goals.
Or the property developer would have the property. The city wouldn't mm-hmm. need to acquire the property under every circumstance. If a property owner were to amass three or four individual lots and seek to redevelop them all in mass, and there's a local street connection shown through there, it provides us the mechanism to require that developer to provide that connectivity at that time.
Okay.
Other questions?
Well done.
Okay. All right.
Number on. 3. Okay. Whoops. Section 3. Easiest 1, 2, 3, maybe. Okay, so TSP project list and figure updates. So this is amending the transportation system plan itself so that the connections that we're showing on the conceptual street map are reflected in the transportation system plan project list and associated figures that are also part of the TSP. Providing consistency with the regional transportation plan that was adopted regionally. Additions of identified needs and opportunities since the plan was adopted back in 2014. We've noticed some items since then that are good to add in and opportunities that we can take advantage of. And then housekeeping updates. So I'll provide some examples of what that looks like. So an example of consistency with the conceptual street map. Some adjustments were made in accordance with the natural area and Lamb Lane previously established agreements within this area that's kind of Thurston Hills, just up from Weyerhaeuser Hall Road. That's the purple dashed line. So this is the conceptual street map as proposed on the right side. And then this is the adopted TSP from 2014 on the left side. And you can see that there's a few different lines. R46 only connected to Mount Vernon Road and up to Mountain Gate Drive, because that local conceptual street wasn't shown there. So then we're proposing to change the project so that the collector street that's in the TSP actually connects to the local and has more connectivity. We're also changing all of the changes in the project list, which is attachment 7, are shown in bright pink. So either strike throughs or addition. All of those changes are shown in color there. Another example is US 7, which is the street going south. The regional transportation plan had this language that's shown in the middle, saying that needs to be modified the three-lane cross-section, and its project extent was from Main Street to South M Street. Our TSP currently says from F Street, so it needs to specify South F, since that's the actual intent of the project, to the UGB. So we've just changed it so the project extents match up with the two documents and the figures. We've added additional needs, for instance, along 48th Street, G Street, and then 52nd. There's needs to improve that roadway. You've been out there recently. You can see it's in pretty poor condition. So we're adding an urban standards project for each of those three segments. Should actually say U.S. These are the types of polishing things that were like, oh, instead of just a U, it's a U.S. urban standards project. And then pairing it with a ped bike multi-use path. And for these projects, we've tied them together to say, okay, you can either build the full package as you go, or the path could come first. We could provide the pedestrian and bicycle element, but if you're going to do the street work, then the multi-use path also needs to be built at the same time to serve as the ped bike element of that roadway. And that kind of responds to, I think, some of your comments submitted about, can we flex in some of the design to have different types of streets that accommodate pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure in a way that makes the most sense. So in this situation, we're tying into the Weyerhaeuser Hall Road to the south and keeping it a consistent off-street path facility that's going to be paired with the roadway really close by, and then connecting up to the future multi-use path along the McKenzie River. There are some needs and opportunities, so we sometimes change the timing of projects. For instance, one of those projects is R44 Daisy Street, the crossing at Bob Straub Parkway. So we're about to go out and start building the Virginia Daisy Bikeway project, and we didn't have funding or within the project scope to cross Bob Straub Parkway, but that's clearly a need that is very timely and needs to be soon, not 20 years from now. So we've changed the project timing from beyond 20-year project to a 20-year project and a priority to get that crossing completed. There's some housekeeping updates. All of the crossings on Main Street were identified in the transportation system plan, but some of the locations have shifted since then. And then at the PB 42 was originally shown at 57th. We're about to go construct that at 66th and Main Street. Now it's going to be a slightly different crossing treatment, a pedestrian hybrid beacon instead of rapid flashing beacon. So we're just changing the name and making sure that everything actually matches what we're building or have already built.
What's a pedestrian hybrid?
Pedestrian hybrid beacon is such as at the hotel in Glenwood with the flashing red that alternates back and forth versus the stutter beam that's an amber bar that flashes like the other ones on Main Street.
Thank you.
And then some housekeeping updates such as clarification. This is a study project looking at the expressway from I-5 to Main Street, but on the figure it's not 100% clear because there's a lot of different study projects and it's a large extent. We're just adding more content to the name to clearly specify what the project extent is and those sorts of changes. So you can see all the changes in attachments 7 and then the visual depiction of those changes in attachment 8 with all of the different figures.
Okay. I've got a couple of things. I see the linear park along the gateway on the south side of the Willamette River, and I see two crossings, one into Island Park and one across to the pathway on the other side further to the west. What I don't see is what we've been advocating, we, the Team Springfield group, for the last several years, is a connector across from the Middle Fork path across the Willamette to the other side.
Correct. So that is the Willamette Lane comprehensive plan. It's outside of the UGB, so we aren't showing multi-use path projects that extend. For instance, there's been talk about some crossings in other river locations that are outside the UGB as well. So those aren't shown within this project list, but they are on the regional transportation plan. They are in the William Lane Comprehensive Plan, that address those geographic areas. Okay.
So the regional transportation plan is the county's plan? Whose plan?
Or maybe it's not in that one, because of the metro. It's the metro document that compiles all of the areas within the Eugene Springfield Metropolitan Central Lane MPO.
Okay.
Area.
So because this is outside of the UGB, it's not part of this planning process.
Correct. It can be supported by the city, but it's not within the scope of this document, as I understand it. But
Lane County TSB.
Yeah, it's also in the Lane County TSB, because that's a Lane County
Excellent. Area.
Good. We're trying to locate things in the right places.
That makes a lot of sense.
Definitely planned. It's definitely conversed about.
Good. Yes, Tim.
You talked about projects being added, projects being modified, and then projects removed from the project list. Because in 2014, there were a number of projects that were included that were very questionable even then as to feasibility.
We're not looking to remove at this point. There were some projects that changed the project extent and for instance, the Millrace path, we're shifting some of the extents for a couple different projects that all tied together to show, okay, this one's fully completed and built, and let's leave a little bit of remainder and put it into the other project that's coming next. But we're not fully removing any.
And I think there was a couple of examples then of projects that potentially the right-of-way was not going to be available at any future time. So obviously they would either have to be completely modified or removed altogether.
Yeah, those on my list is beyond 20 years. I'm not sure. We weren't looking to do a full TSP update. This is trying to keep it within the confines.
Well, yeah, I'm about the project list.
Things that are needed to be consistent or are additions.
So the completed items you're just leaving in?
Yes. Yeah, because they go into the assumptions for the 2035 TSP. In our personal spreadsheets, we're making notes as to, okay, these have been completed. Great, we're making progress. But it's a 20-year plan through 2035. And when we do a more robust TSP update, we can address some of those items.
Another problematic area is where 126 converges with 42nd Street, and I know that's been a focus for a time. I think that's 126. I think that is in the current plan, because
yes.
I thought I heard that there was some funding coming our direction for a project there.
Correct. So it is in the current TSP in a few different ways. There's a project on 42nd Street, and then there's also a separate project that calls out some of the interchange treatments within that area where there's a lot going on. The House Bill 2017 that the state legislature just passed in the last session allocated funding to work on 42nd Street.
Yes.
So that will be moving forward as well, although the time frame, they don't have construction funds coming for several more years.
How about the levee along the 42nd Street that has the path on top of it?
Mm-hmm.
That's an issue as well. Is that part of this? I mean, is that in this list as well?
There is no specific project for the multi-use path facility since it's already built. That's not identified in the TSP. There's some considerations with the funded 42nd Street project of how is there connectivity from 42nd Street to and from the path facility, because there's not great connections at the moment if you're trying to access it not at one of the ends.
Well, it's just that there are that levee that runs along 42nd Street, I think, needs some additional support.
I can speak to that.
Yeah.
If Ken Vogel, the former city manager and current emergency manager, I mean, city engineer and current emergency manager for the city were here, he could talk about it for 2 hours. But essentially, that levee is a flood control facility.
Yes.
And it currently does not, may not, probably not meet levee standards.
Yeah.
In order to serve as a flood control facility, so we've been working with FEMA around that and have a kind of a path forward. If you think about probably how many levees there are across the United States that no longer meet FEMA's requirements for a flood control facility, this is an enormously expensive issue. So FEMA's found a way to kind of give the city and many cities a buy on this question for now to continue flood insurance. And I do know that Ken is looking for funding to investigate the levee. The problem is if we use federal money to drill into the levee and we don't have any as-builts on the levee. I mean, it's just there. And we discover that there are issues that we're going to be held immediately accountable for correction.
Yeah.
So we're trying to find the best path to get good information about this facility without being required to immediately upgrade it or fix it. It's probably 2 feet too short, depending on which models you look at and which rain events. Levees now are required to have headboard that's above the rain event, you know, the flooding standard. So we're on it, we're working on it, and just not within TSP or
but it's out.
And as Emma points out, the bike fed facility is on the top of the levee, and the levee encroaches one side of 42nd Street, and then there's the water quality channel,
yes,
drainage ditch, or Salmonberry Street, whatever you choose to think of it as, on the other side. So figuring out 42nd Street is going to be real interesting.
Good. I appreciate that. Thanks. Yes.
You're aware that at the time that that was under county jurisdiction, that they had a design in place. I don't know if you've ever seen that, because they had the design, but of course they didn't have the funding. So is that something that you were aware of when you're looking at possible design options?
No, and I think we'll follow up with you to try to kind of mine that information out and then maybe push
that. They may have destroyed it by now, I don't know.
Yeah, so they designed it but didn't build it?
Well, they didn't build it because of funding, which is always an issue.
Right.
But they had the design in place because people have been clamoring for improvements for decades.
So what we really don't know is that what got built was per that design, but it's still merit.
Well, I mean, it hasn't really changed since then at all. So the design was an upgrade that they had contemplated.
Okay. Okay, that's excellent information. We appreciate that.
But again, it may not be in existence anymore since they've released the jurisdiction. They may not have considered the design to be worth anything anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, or, right. But it's another place to look.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Good. Any other questions for Emma? Okay, so let's go back to our schedule.
Oh, there it is. Great.
So City Council is going to review this at a work session on December 4th. Is that what you said?
Correct.
Yeah. And we're looking for a joint county PC work session on the 23rd, which could be... so pre-work session and then a public hearing is what you're thinking.
Yeah, I'm trying to confirm if that's the right route to go, if you feel like you're ready to take that as your next step with both the second and third bullet point, in which case we'll be providing the public notice in mid-December and then providing opportunities for people who have questions to drop in and get some of their questions answered prior to that public hearing sometime earlier in January.
I mean, I think that sounds good. I mean, there's been how long have you been in this in the process?
Our sinus lights started at the city a little over 2 years ago.
2 years.
It kicked off after the TSP was adopted in 2014, but then there were several staff turnover and transition items. So the project really got launched, I would say, about a year and a half ago.
Well, the one thing that I did think was important is that you circle back with your advisory group on the map. Make sure that they have a good opportunity to review it and vet it. And then I think that any feedback that you receive from that, I think it would be beneficial for the Planning Commission to see. And then we don't, are we, do we have any, are we off the month of December? We have, you said we have a meeting scheduled, but nothing
December
on the calendar.
December, there's nothing on here.
Yeah. Yes.
Approval on January 23rd could either be joint approval or independent approval if the county or the city is thinking in a different direction from each other?
Correct. That gives you an opportunity to speak, and I would hope that there would be enough communication to get to the joint agreement.
So, I, you know, I think that time frame, I mean, I think this is, you've done an enormous amount of work, and I think that I think this is a good, complete document. I think the piece that I'd like to hear is any feedback from your advisory group on the map, and also we need to review the elements of this that have not been included in this document. So we probably ought to, when do you think those, when do you think that could be accomplished?
We may be able to send those out in advance of the packet. Otherwise, we typically just provide it as your normal review prior to the January 23rd meeting.
Okay, that's fine.
It's not going to be very lengthy. I mean, you got the bulk of the content today.
Okay. Okay, as long as it's not, you know, voluminous and, you know, we, it's
we're
just
talking a number of sheets,
and
something like this.
All right. Yeah, that's fine. I think that works. I think that works well. And then this is a, this will be a legislative process.
Correct.
Is that correct, legal counsel?
That's correct. Not calling the issue.
All right. I would just, you know, legislative process for us, it's important that we do, we can talk about this, is what I'm saying for the commissioners. If, you know, if you want to talk to somebody about this moving forward, this is a time to communicate and bring feedback back to the process. So what Emma indicated was they were going to send out a notice to, because this is broad, far-reaching, every resident or homeowner in the
real property owner,
in the within our UGB, right?
Correct.
So so it's a big process. So you know, that type of communication, if somebody walks up to you and says, I'd like to talk about this transportation thing that's going on, you know, you're welcome to do that, because this is a legislative process, and bring that input. I know you interact, Commissioner Nelson, with a lot of real estate folks about, you know, things that are going on and the realities of development and those types of things. So, and it's good to have that perspective come to this process. So, and we all have different folks that we interact with in the community. So, I think this time frame looks doable,
and that will provide you the opportunity. You could have a public hearing and deliberate on the 23rd, and then do a recommendation on the 6th if you wanted, or you could do all of it in one evening.
It just depends. It depends, I would imagine, on how much public input we get to the process. So. So we'll just need to see, right? So does that, do we have general head nods and consensus around this? Yes? Okay, is that what you need from us tonight?
That's helpful, yeah.
All right, okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We stand adjourned. Oh, did you, someone had...
Well, I had a question, but it's unrelated to the agenda, so I didn't want to hold
okay,
up staff
we'll
for that.
We'll just...
Okay.
You're have a private conversation.
Well, I mean, the reason I brought it up is because it may be interesting.
I saw your wife, and I looked at her, and she looked at me, and so Tim was it. I knew I recognized her, but I couldn't place it.
We haven't seen up in Europe. How long?
I know, we set out.
What, about 15 years ago?
Thank you for this.